mean, it started a week ago, actually, today. Basically, the police started by harassing different anarchists that are active in Kirksville, Missouri. And at the same time that was happening, they raided two houses in Denver, Colorado. And we got both of those phone calls more or less at the same time. They were asking questions about the Democratic and Republican national conventions, and also about the elections and the upcoming presidential debates that'll be going on in St. Louis that different anarchists in this region are organizing around. And then the next day, I woke up to four people on the front porch of the house I was staying at, relating a story of how the FBI had come to one of their relatives' houses. So that morning we sort of set up shop in the local community center, info shop that we have here in Lawrence called the Solidarity Center. And Kansas Mutual Aid immediately started taking phone calls from anyone that was reporting FBI activity in their town. And we got phone calls from Columbia, Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, Kirksville, Missouri, Topeka, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, and as well as all over Lawrence, Kansas, and then some more calls from Denver, Colorado. It seemed like most of the things that we were experiencing locally here in Lawrence, the FBI was targeting people's workplaces, neighbors, friends and relatives, but wasn't really having much success supposedly finding the anarchists they were looking for. From our perspective, it looked a lot like intimidation and harassment, because they knew exactly where we would have been, which was a Solidarity Center where we had about 20 to 30 people all day working on various aspects of organizing against this these scare tactics. We also had local media there with us all day, just in case anything happened, and we were able to coordinate a really amazing response to this in such a short amount of time. But since Friday of last week, the FBI sort of left us alone here in Lawrence over the weekend, but we received a call from people that are active in Kirksville, Missouri, saying that they actually had been harassed all through the week by, or the weekend, by the FBI, and they had gone to St. Louis to visit friends, and that there were four FBI agents staked outside the house they were staying at 24 hours a day, nonstop. Wherever they went, they were followed by four unmarked cars. That morning on Monday, we started to get word that people in Lawrence had been receiving FBI visits. And then we were also given word that three people from Kirksville, Missouri, who were in St. Louis, had been subpoenaed to speak in front of a grand jury on Thursday morning in St. Louis.
Which will be this morning as we're listening to this. Why are these people being brought before a grand jury? And I'm just curious about the legal, I'm not too familiar with the legal system. We don't really have an equivalent of the grand jury system here in Canada. So I'm curious about what they're saying their reasons for calling these people in front of a grand jury are. I understand that from what I've read, that this is used as a investigative tool sometimes by various prosecutors.
Yeah, basically the grand jury is a tool to receive information or intelligence. The way this works is the grand jury subpoenas are to gather any sort of information that supposedly a federal grand jury in the United States will need to issue an indictment at a later time. So it's a investigation by this body to see if crimes have been or would have been committed if they hadn't gotten involved, and what charges, if any, and who to level them against based on the information they receive during their questioning. But historically, the grand juries have been used, the earliest that we can think of used against anarchists was during the Palmer raids here in the United States, in which thousands of trade unionists and anarchists were deported from the United States, and a lot of these indictments against these people who were deported were brought about in grand juries. And later on in the movement, throughout the years between now and then, they've been used again against different anarchists and against communists and anarchists during the McCarthyist era here in the United States, and also against anti-war activist during the 1960s and 70s, and then again during the 1980s against underground activist movements such as the BLA or the Weather Underground here in the United States. And basically, they're a way that the government can question people in the United States without the people having any real rights to defend themselves in any way.
Or legal representation.
Yeah, exactly. When you're in a grand jury, you're not allowed a lawyer. The only people that are allowed in the room with you are the grand jury, which consists of 16 to 23 people, the judge, and then the U.S. attorneys, and then yourself. So there's plenty of people that'll be asking you questions, but you're the only person that can be there. And they can also force immunity upon you, which means that supposedly your testimony won't be used against you.
So the Fifth Amendment goes out the window.
Yeah, exactly. If when immunity is forced upon you, it also brings into these rules that when they ask you any question, you have to answer it. Otherwise, you will be jailed until you do. So there's been cases of activists across the country in the past being jailed for months and even years at a time for refusing to answer grand jury questions. Even though they never committed a crime, they were just wanted for questioning, supposedly. They become penalized for refusing to answer a question. And a lot of these rules were added by Nixon in the 1960s to kind of destroy the anti-war movement, and have been practiced ever since to disrupt social movements like ours.
I guess it's fair to say that in the 60s it was less than successful at reaching whatever their objective was. I mean, the anti-war movement was very large after that, despite this kind of intimidation.
Definitely, but just like what happened with COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program here in the United States, all these tactics by the government were able to be used in such a way that they were, effective to a certain extent, in that they marginalized different parts of the movement, particularly militant parts of the movement or groups or parts of the movement that were willing to take civil disobedience or direct action. They were marginalized from the movement, as well as groups like the Black Panthers, where grand juries and other tactics were used at the same time, such as intimidation and murder on a whole scale or wholesale here in the United States. To basically splinter them and divide them and have more infighting amongst them. Because when you have people potentially who are forced to answer questions in which they give away information about people that they're working with on a close level, it really divides people and scares people about who they want to share certain information with, because anyone then becomes a potential enemy within your movement because they can be subpoenaed and then used against you. So it's really hard to maintain a level of trust that we need within social movements when grand juries and other tactics like this are used.
Do you have any idea how, I mean, it seems like there are there this FBI questioning or harassment, intimidation is going on in a lot of places. Do you have any idea how many people have been affected by this?
Well, here in Lawrence, we can think that there were at least 20 people in various ways they tried to contact, and the number may have gone up by now, but at least 20 anarchists that we can think of that either they contacted their co-workers, their neighbors, or their family in certain ways, or themselves, because as of Monday they were successful in finally reaching some of the Lawrence anarchists.
So the Lawrence Journal World is incorrect when they're, it seems as though the mainstream media keeps giving the number of Lawrence anarchists that have been questioned as two in a couple of the articles I've read. One was an Associated Press article, and one was by a guy named Eric Westlander. I don't know if you've read these.
Yeah, that came out today, actually. And that's pretty accurate, because only a couple more have actually been talked to, but the thing is, that's only taking into account people who have been directly contacted by the FBI, because I know my roommate, who identifies as an anarchist, he may not be active right now, but he was called in relation to me and asked questions about me and also my other roommate who's active, and they're not counting him or other people like him who have been contacted in their estimates. And, I mean, you know, in various ways, and people's parents, people's grandparents, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, all sorts of relatives, people who are neighbors to our info shop and neighbors around other people's houses in our town. They went to my workplace, you know. I mean, it all adds up to about 20 to 25 people that they were targeting in Lawrence to somehow harass or intimidate. But on a grander scale, it's probably right around the 40 to 50 mark of people they've either contacted or people they've supposedly tried to contact here in the Midwest. So
generally, they're getting in touch with, as you say, parents, roommates, employers. Is there any suggestion that they're avoiding speaking with people directly in favor of questioning their families or coworkers? Or I'm just wondering why they're not talking to people directly, because it doesn't seem like they are in the case of Lawrence, apparently the vast majority of the people they're interested in.
Yeah, I know I was personally never contacted, and I really, the only explanation that we have is that, is one that makes much more sense in our minds, is that this is not a part of any sort of investigation into a crime, but this is instead an attempt by the FBI, along with the grand jury subpoenas, to harass and intimidate us, because a lot more pressure starts to build when you start to get FBI visits at work and FBI visits to your employer and FBI visits to your family. All these people start to apply pressure to you in various ways to stop the actions that you're doing, or if you're not doing anything, to not take those actions in the future, such as going to protests or demos or community organizing. And so this is a really effective way of applying a lot of pressure onto various people within our movement through other people. Like, they're using other people to apply pressure to us to stop doing what we're doing. And also it becomes very tricky, because I know that there are several parents of different people in this movement here in town in Lawrence that aren't U.S. citizens. And so it becomes very shaky ground when they start to get visits from the FBI, because then they're put in a real risk. And so there's a lot of different thoughts that go into that when you start to weigh the fact that your parents can become deported because of the actions that you're doing, or at least there's that threat. And the FBI really wants to remind us that there's that threat, and that things like the Palmer raids and other things that happened throughout our history here in the United States aren't just part of the history, but can be part of our future as well.
Have there been any arrests associated with this wave of intimidation? Or
there were two arrests of anarchists in Denver, Colorado, but it seems like they were just picked up. They were originally, as far as we know, they were in federal custody. However, they were transferred to local custody. Excuse me. And then from there, they were just charged with minor crimes. One had a bench warrant for unpaid bike tickets. Another had a bench warrant for missing a court date for some unrelated infraction. And so it just seemed like it was an easy way, while they were intimidating and harassing people, it was easy for them to go ahead and run their names, their IDs, and if they could pick them up for any crime at that point, they would. And again, this follows the same pattern from the 1960s and 70s in which radicals and dissidents within the anti-war movement and also within the Black Power movement were continually arrested and confined for really minor violations. However, this kept resources and money and them tied up and unable to keep working and performing the community organizing and the other work they were performing at the time. So it follows the same pattern. Like, this is nothing new. It's just new that it's targeting us here in the Midwest at this state, because I know the East Coast and the West Coast have been continually harassed for the past couple of years by the FBI and by other agents of the state. But we here in the Midwest have finally started to really organize and become really active in our communities, and now that we're here and they know that we're probably not going away on our own, they're going to try to apply as much pressure as they can before we become a real movement to be reckoned with out here. So.
Now, what we've read in or what I've been able to piece together from various mainstream news articles is that they're looking for information about specific threats that have been cited in a couple of mainstream news reports, but they are typically unsourced or unconfirmed or In the case of, I don't know, did you catch the article in the New York Daily News? The headline was "Fury at Anarchist Convention Threat," and it talks specifically about internet. This is a quote: "Internet using anarchists are telling would-be troublemakers to decoy specially trained Labrador retrievers with gunpowder or ammonium nitrate-laced tablets in a bid to halt trains or even spur the evacuation of Madison Square Garden." This seems like hysteria.
Yeah, I can definitely agree. I don't know. I don't know where their sources are for those article or for that article in particular.
Well, they don't give a source. Actually, there is no source.
Well, I mean, it just makes so much sense. Historically, I mean, what do you do first? You start to demonize your opponent, and in this case, all freedom-loving people are the opponent of the state forces, and so we become demonized as active members of a movement that supports freedom. And once they dehumanize us and demonize us, it's much easier for them to show up at our homes with the FBI and subpoena us and start taking us away. And it becomes much harder for us to receive widespread support, either out of fear or out of the fact that we are now the new terrorists, you know. A lot of what we experienced here in town, there were a lot of sympathetic ears when we were trying to explain what was going on. But on the other hand, we also live in a country where supposedly you are innocent until proven guilty, but the direct mindset is if the state's going to level charges against you, you must have done something wrong. So actually you're guilty until proven innocent, and even then you're still probably guilty. And so we live in a situation right now where there's a real fear amongst us that we do have a lot of community support, but on the other hand, it'd be really easy for them to allege any sort of number of terrorist acts that we would have committed, and the second it comes out of their mouth, it becomes truth, and then we become terrorists, and we're no longer the community organizers that we were. We're just now aiders and abettors of Al-Qaeda and people who hate America and who hate freedom.
When in reality, the exact opposite is the case.
Exactly. We definitely try to oppose people who take away freedom and oppose people who will destroy this country and the people in it and the environment in it and the living beings that call this country home. We stand, you know, directly opposed to coercion and support freedom, and that's what we're trying to realize in our communities right now, trying to build a real movement for direct democracy, which is why we're such a threat, because we are everything that they aren't. We oppose everything that they are.
Right. And I was going to also add to what I was saying before that some of the stories that are coming out about the alleged threat include things like I read in the same Lawrence Journal World article that I referred to earlier, a tip that a group planned to firebomb media vehicles. And also, I read in another article that I sadly couldn't find before I came down. I wish I had been able to, but they were talking about car bombs.
Yeah, it seems like whatever information supposedly the FBI has, they don't even know what it is, because they've been giving us many different reasons for their investigation. And in fact, the closest, I think, the most consistent excuse is for supposedly a tip that a group in the Midwest was going to be firebombing, as you were saying, or I guess attacking media vehicles with incendiary devices, exactly how they put it. I guess it's really interesting where they got this tip, and especially how it relates to a whole bunch of people here in the Midwest, that none of us were planning on going to the Democratic National Convention anyway. We're all involved with a lot of community projects right now, which are in a lot of stages where we have to be here for them to happen and to foster their growth. And so none of us were going to go to the Democratic National Convention, and it's interesting that we became targets of this investigation. We're really far away from Boston. Some of us are thinking about going to New York for the Republican National Convention, just because it works out better time-wise, because it's at the end of August. But here in Lawrence, I mean, there's so much going on right now. We're in the middle of moving season, you know. Our leases all end on this Saturday, so we're all moving. There's no way we could have made it to Boston, and it's interesting that we became the targets.
Yeah, and of course there are organized anarchists all across the United States who are, you know, I mean, some are many in the Boston area, as a matter of fact, and we're not hearing stories of those people being, you know, questioned or harassed by the FBI at all, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, there are some stories coming out of Boston of them being harassed, but it seems like that comes out of the general, the same general pattern of harassment that comes out before any sort of major mobilization happens in your city. You know, the anarchists become demonized and become criminalized, and they do become investigated in some ways, but it seems, at least from our perspective, this could be wrong, and maybe someone from Boston could clarify at a future date, but from what we've been reading, at least from indie media and other things, is that it seems kind of consistent with how it's always been. However, this kind of large-scale crackdown on Midwestern anarchists is kind of new, and something that we haven't seen, at least I haven't seen since I became active in the past 5 or 6 years, anything quite like this. But on the other hand, I've never seen the types of organizations that we're building now, the networking that we're doing now, where we have, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 cities all across the Midwest that are producing lots of collectives and community centers and info shops and working together in a networked, organized fashion and actually starting to build the networks that we need to build a movement. I mean, this also comes off, right after we organized a big conference here in Lawrence called the We Are Resisting Conference, which brought together about 200 to 300 left-leaning or anarchist-minded people from across the Midwest and actually across the country. To hear such speakers as Ward Churchill and Roxanne Number Ortiz and other people who have been building social movements for years. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty important conference for us because it sort of started to take the light away from protest-based activism to real community building and movement building and ideas for how we can actually create a sustainable social movement. And it was a real big step in the evolution of whatever we're trying to build out here. And this just comes 3 weeks after that. So it's interesting that all this is coinciding.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that people are looking at this and starting to realize that there might be other tactics the state will start to use in the future against us, and that this is just the beginning of whatever, this is just the beginning of any sort of crackdown on anarchists in the Midwest or anarchists in this country.
Well, it's the same thing that's happened with the environmental movement, environmentalist movement lately, and that's that instead of the word environmentalist, the mainstream media will use the word eco-terrorist all of
Definitely,
a sudden.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of thing. So I just want to be very clear on this point. It doesn't seem like there is any reasonable basis for the kind of intimidation that you're seeing right now.
Definitely not. I mean, what we do here in Lawrence is we run a community center, we run a library, we serve a weekly meal to the homeless, and we organize workers' unions, we do support for political and other prisoners imprisoned across the Midwest, and it's just really interesting that what we do is so transparent. We invite people to everything we do. Nothing we do is really secretive at all. Every meeting we have, everything we do is open to the public to join. On the other hand, this is something that's interesting, is the FBI has been really secretive about all this and not transparent.
Right.
And we invite people to everything we do. We don't have anything to hide. That's part of the movement we're trying to build, is one based on trust and transparency. And I guess if feeding the homeless or organizing our communities is terrorism, then we're definitely guilty. But as far as the definition that they're applying to us of what we are, we're definitely not that.
And it seems like these are really thinly veiled attacks in the media from my point of view, when I'm reading them, I'm just throwing my hands up in the air and going, I can't even believe that they're getting away with printing this stuff. But so assuming that the goal is to intimidate people out of participating in certain events, do you think that this is going to have a real effect on the organizing that you're doing, or do you think it might backfire on them and just increase people's resolve and determination to fight against what is rather, you know, a ridiculous charade.
Well, I definitely, when this first hit on Friday, at least first hit in Lawrence, there was definitely that real fear that this was going to be it. Everyone was going to submit to whatever fears we were having, and that was going to be the end of all the hard work we've been putting in. And I had hoped that wouldn't be the case, and I've been really pleasantly, I'm not even really surprised, but basically our community has become tighter than it ever has before, and we've been receiving offers of help from corners that we never knew existed here, at least in Lawrence, and this is the same kind of information that we're getting from other people who are active in the Midwest, that people in their communities have been really supportive and are really, for the most part, at least the left-leaning folks are really upset with what's going on, and this has galvanized us into an even stronger movement. And I think in the long run, it opens up a lot of our eyes to the fact that this is a really serious thing that we're involved with. And I think it's definitely going to harden our resolve, and we're not going anywhere. Our goal is to create a sustainable movement for direct democracy, and we're not going to fail.
Okay. I wanted to know what exactly, I mean, because the group that the Kansas Mutual Aid Group Collective, I should say, that you're involved with is currently organizing support, legal support for some of the people affected by this. I'm just kind of curious about what specifically is being organized support-wise.
Well, right now we're still trying to collect people's statements on what's happened, and at least the people in Denver and here in Lawrence are starting to combine those reports and hand them over to groups like the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild to work with. And a lot of people are under the impression that this could be the basis for some sort of lawsuit or some sort of retaliatory measures in the courts against the FBI, especially if nothing comes out of this investigation besides the intimidation and harassment that we're describing. Mm-hmm. If there's no if there's no arrests or if there's no uncovering of some secret supposed terrorist plot that they say we're a part of. But right now we're trying to raise legal funds just in case the subpoenas start to spread, because fortunately our comrades in Kirksville have been receiving free legal assistance, and they've got really good lawyers that are helping them for free. But we're positive that if any more of us get subpoenaed, that probably won't be the case.
Right.
So those are things that we're doing. And we're also just trying to raise awareness about grand juries and how they work, and how we as a movement and we as anarchists can start to prepare ourselves for any sort of tactics like these, just in case they come for us next. And we probably have, I mean, ideas that are circulating right now is we probably want to start doing trainings on how to deal with the FBI and how to deal with grand juries, as well as other legal trainings on how to organize legal collectives in your town and how to organize the sort of measures that we took the day the FBI showed up here in Lawrence. So
it's stuff like what to do if you're confronted by law enforcement people, knowing your rights, whether you have to identify yourself. I'm guessing that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just sort of gauging ourselves and our interactions and just preparing people for talking to the FBI, because I think fortunately a lot of us had either dealt with some sort of police interaction before, or we've had really good trainings where the FBI really hasn't been able to question any, like the people they've actually contacted have not answered their questions. Everyone in this region has refused to talk to them, and that's something that I think comes from a lot of mental preparation for any situation like this. There could be a time in the future, however, that they contact someone that doesn't really know what to do in that situation, and it could become really dangerous for them or other people around, because people like the FBI are really good at making you say things that may or may not necessarily be true.
Well, I did read in posting from one of the people in Denver that they had some confusion about the appropriate way to respond to law enforcement there, and that could have it evidently led to a couple of them being arrested.
Yeah, definitely. you know, there's also a lot of confusion, and this is something that we're going to have to do as a legal collective, is do a lot more research and talk to a lot more lawyers, because we've been getting conflicting answers as to whether or not we have to identify ourselves to police officers, because there was that new Supreme Court ruling just a couple weeks ago that we have been told makes it illegal for you to decline to give your identification to a police officer or to an FBI agent or any agent in the state. So there's been a lot of confusion as to what exactly we have to do. And I don't think, I think fortunately, or unfortunately for us, but fortunately for the FBI, they can use that confusion against us, and we really need these answers, and we're going to have to start working on these things and having solutions for any sort of possible or any future activities that might come from the FBI or from police.
Right. Okay, I've realized I've probably kept you on the phone for a little longer than I said I would, but I'm sure there will be people listening to this that will want to do something to help. So what are you asking for right now?
Well, I guess I'm asking for people who hear about this story to spread that news, and also we will be posting constant updates to infoshop.org, which has been really good at getting out our story to a lot of people. All we had to do was post a couple reports on that website, and people have been calling us from all across the country asking for interviews or asking for how they can help or trying to spread this word across. So I guess I'll be checking that website for updates and also be spreading those updates to everyone, because I think the most important thing we have now is this solid network of people who are informing each other and informing the world of what's happening to us. And also, something else that we'd ask is for people to prepare in their own communities and neighborhoods, just in case something like this happens, and start to think about how they would deal with a similar threat. And I guess also one thing I want to say is we don't think this is over by any means. We don't think that they're just going to spend a week harassing us and that's going to be the end of it. We are really worried about any sort of legal actions they try to take in the future, especially with these grand jury subpoenas. These kind of took us off guard. So we are asking for legal funds, and I hate doing that. But we will be accepting legal funds